From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The health care bill that was passed ultimately will be seen as a victory for capitalism because it protected the capitalist model of providing health care for people. In other words, we're not to help people unless there's money to be made from it.
As President Obama signs the landmark health care overhaul bill today, we talk with Academy Award-winning filmmaker Michael Moore. Then, while Secretary of State Hillary Clinton criticizes Israel for expanding Jewish settlements, she reaffirms U.S. support.
For President Obama and for me, and for this entire administration, our commitment to Israel's security and Israel's future is rock solid, unwavering, enduring, and forever.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is also in Washington and will meet with President Obama today. We'll speak with Norman Finkelstein, author of the new book, This Time We Went Too Far, Truth and Consequences of the Gaza Invasion. He's also the subject of a new documentary called American Radical. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Obama signing the health care reform bill today, just 2 days after its passage by the House. The signing ceremony comes ahead of a new round of votes in the Senate, where Republicans will attempt to derail a separate package of health care amendments. Republicans are also planning challenges from the state level in a bid to repeal the bill. 11 Republican state attorneys general are preparing lawsuits challenging the constitutionality of the bill for mandating people to buy health insurance. We'll have more on the health care bill with filmmaker Michael Moore after headlines. In other news from Washington, the Senate Banking Committee has advanced Democratic Senator Christopher Dodd's measure to overhaul financial regulation. Critics have faulted Dodd's proposal for giving new power to the Federal Reserve while gutting the proposed Consumer Financial Protection Agency and housing it inside the Fed. But the measure also includes new protections and incentives for Wall Street whistleblowers and the establishment of an oversight body for credit rating agencies. The measure now goes before the full Senate. President Obama hosts Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House today in their first meeting since Israel's announcement of a major settlement expansion in East Jerusalem. On Monday, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton told the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee conference that the U.S. commitment to Israel is, quote, rock solid. But Clinton also criticized Israel for continuing to build East Jerusalem settlements.
New construction in East Jerusalem or the West Bank undermines that mutual trust and endangers the proximity talks that are the first step toward the full negotiations that both sides say they want and need. And it exposes daylight between Israel and the United States that others in the region hope to exploit. It undermines America's unique ability to play a role, an essential role, in the peace process.
In a defiant speech hours after Clinton's address, Netanyahu rejected U.S. criticism and vowed to continue building settlements.
The Jewish people were building Jerusalem 3,000 years ago, and the Jewish people are building Jerusalem today. Jerusalem is not a settlement. It's our capital. Everyone knows. Everyone, Americans, Europeans, Israelis certainly, Palestinians, everyone knows that these neighborhoods will be part of Israel in any peace settlement. And therefore, building in them in no way precludes the possibility of a two-state solution.
Activists with the group Code Pink twice interrupted Netanyahu's speech with calls to freeze settlement building and end the U.S.-backed blockade of the Gaza Strip. One protester said Israel is guilty of war crimes.
Today, an unprecedented threat to humanity looms large. A radical Iranian regime
Earlier in the day, Code Pink pulled off a hoax by releasing a fake press release in AIPAC's name, calling for a complete freeze on Israeli settlements in the occupied territories. Code Pink members also dressed up in suits and handed out copies of the statement outside the AIPAC conference to confuse attendees. Several major news outlets picked up the statement before AIPAC issued a denial. We'll have more with author Norman Finkelstein later in the broadcast. The Los Angeles Times is reporting the Obama administration's considering a plan to jail foreign prisoners at the Bagram prison in Afghanistan instead of at Guantanamo Bay. Using Bagram would allow the administration to meet its pledge to close Guantanamo while still denying prisoners the right to challenge their detentions in U.S. courts. The plan would also help the White House evade scrutiny for the torture and mistreatment of prisoners because they would remain jailed off U.S. soil. The Los Angeles Times also reports U.S. officials decided to kill a foreign suspect in Somalia last year, in part due to uncertainty over where he would be jailed if captured. The suspect, Salah Ali Salah Naban, was killed in a U.S. airstrike after U.S. officials decided they wouldn't know where to imprison him. A federal judge has ordered the release of a Guantanamo prisoner who's claimed to have suffered extensive torture and abuse during nearly 8 years in U.S. captivity. Mohamedou Slahi arrived at Guantanamo in August 2002 after turning himself in the year before in his native Mauritania. Under special interrogation techniques authorized by then-Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, Slahi was subjected to sleep deprivation, extreme heat and cold, death threats, and told his mother would be jailed if he didn't cooperate. Slahi is the 34th Guantanamo prisoner ordered released since the Supreme Court ruled prisoners can challenge their detention in U.S. courts. Iraq's Election Commission has rejected a call from Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki for a recount of this month's parliamentary elections. Maliki's coalition is in a tight race with an alliance headed by former interim Prime Minister Ayad Alawi. Full results are expected on Friday. In Afghanistan, President Hamid Karzai held talks Monday with representatives of the Islamic Party, one of the largest militant groups fighting Afghan and NATO forces. Karzai is planning a peace jirga, or assembly, next month with several other militant groups. The U.S. military, meanwhile, has confirmed it's ended poppy eradication in several areas of Afghanistan. U.S. forces have previously targeted Afghan farmers responsible for poppy crops that produce large quantities of opium and heroin. But the U.S. says it's ended the eradications in a bid to win over Afghan support. A U.S. military official said, quote, "We don't trample the livelihood of those we're trying to win over." Former Presidents George W. Bush and Bill Clinton visited Haiti Monday in their capacity as co-chairs of the U.S. relief effort there. Dozens of Haitians took part in a protest in the capital, Port-au-Prince, to denounce the former president's policies in Haiti while in office. Bush cut off vital aid to Haiti and backed the overthrow of Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Bush's father, former President George H.W. Bush, supported the first coup against Aristide in 1991. Clinton, meanwhile, helped restore Aristide, but only on condition he accept harsh neoliberal reforms. Protester Elizabeth Pierre singled out Bush, who was making his first-ever visit to Haiti.
I hear that former President George Bush is here. I'm asking President Clinton to excuse himself so I can talk to George Bush, because George Bush is President Aristide's kidnapper.
Clinton, meanwhile, said he and Bush discussed Haiti's reconstruction needs and pledged to seek congressional backing for a law granting trade preferences to Haitian products.
And we spent most of our time talking today about what needs to be done now so that the economic plan and the donor conference to be held at the end of this month has a chance to work. So we pledged to do what we could to get the changes adopted by Congress that will enable you to make maximum use of this law, and I think could create more than 100,000 jobs in Haiti in short order.
The United Nations marked World Water Day Monday with a warning that unsafe water kills more people than wars and all other forms of violence combined. According to the World Health Organization, 1.5 million people under the age of 5 die every year from war-related diseases. Also marking World Water Day, Bolivian President Evo Morales called on the UN to declare access to safe water a universal human right.
The United Nations, in its 65th session, should approve the following. declare access to portable water and basic sanitation a universal human right, so that states and the UN move forward in respect to this right, and use progressive national and international measures to universally apply it.
The internet giant Google has closed its online search engine in China just 2 months after threatening to leave over censorship and cyber attacks from local hackers. Google's now directing Chinese users to an uncensored search engine based in Hong Kong. Most other Google operations will continue to operate in China. The anti-poverty group Acorn has announced it's shutting down as a national organization. Acorn says a sharp decline in funding will force the group's remaining local chapters to close their doors at the end of the month. Acorn has been embroiled in legal and financial difficulties since last year's release of videos appearing to show staffers offering advice to right-wing activists posing as a pimp and prostitute. The videos help fuel a new right-wing campaign against Acorn, which has long been targeted for its work, helping low-income Americans with voter registration, tax problems, and foreclosures. Congress voted to defund Acorn last year, only to have the move later ruled unconstitutional. A number of large chapters, including Acorn New York and California, have already broken off from the national group. Another offshoot, formerly known as Acorn Housing, will continue its work advising low-income homeowners under the name of Affordable Housing Centers of America. The New York Times, meanwhile, has admitted to making errors in its reporting on the Acorn controversy. Public editor Clark Hoyt says the New York Times mistakenly reinforced some of the falsehoods of the right-wing activists who tried to discredit Acorn with the undercover video. Hoyt says the activists falsely gave the impression they were dressed in outlandish costumes when they visited Acorn offices. He also said video transcripts contradict claims that Acorn staffers appeared to endorse talk of using underage girls as prostitutes. Instead, Acorn staffers appeared to believe they were discussing a plan to protect the girls from an abusive pimp. Hoyt issued his findings in response to a complaint from the group Fairness and Accuracy in reporting. The Associated Press is reporting federal prosecutors are considering filing weapons charges against former top officials at the private military firm Blackwater. Former Blackwater president Gary Jackson and former Blackwater lawyer Andrew Howell have been named as possible suspects in a case alleging the company illegally stockpiled automatic weapons at its North Carolina headquarters. The military contractors Halliburton and KBR have withdrawn an appeal asking the Supreme Court to block a lawsuit by a former employee who says she was raped by co-workers in Iraq. Jamie Lee Jones sued Halliburton and its former subsidiary KBR over claims she was drugged and gang-raped by co-workers in Baghdad. Jones also accused KBR officials of keeping her in a shipping container without food or water for at least 24 hours after the alleged crime took place. Halliburton and KBR had maintained Jones' contract requires claims to be settled through arbitration, not trial. But the companies now say they've withdrawn their appeal to avoid violating recent federal protections approved by Congress partially in response to Jones' case. And the lone person to confess to killing Malcolm X has been granted parole. 45 years after the murder, Thomas Hagen has been jailed since February 21, 1965, when he and several others shot Malcolm X as he spoke before a packed audience in Harlem's Audubon Ballroom. Hagen has been on work release for over 20 years, but has still been required to spend 2 days a week in a Manhattan prison. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Sharif Abdelkadous.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers. President Barack Obama is planning to sign the main health care overhaul bill this morning at a White House ceremony. The legislation is seen as the president's signature domestic priority and has been described as the broadest piece of social policy legislation since President Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. Meanwhile, Senate Republicans are planning to make a last push this week to derail a package of amendments to the health care legislation passed by the House. In addition, 11 state attorneys general, all Republican, are also planning lawsuits challenging the constitutionality of the bill for mandating people to buy health insurance. The legislation's also been criticized by advocates for a single-payer system and abortion rights. In order to secure support from anti-choice Democrats, including Bart Stupak of Michigan, President Obama issued an executive order affirming the Hyde Amendment, which prohibits federal funds from being spent on abortion. On Monday, Amy Goodman and I interviewed someone who's taken on the healthcare system in a big way.
We got an issue in America. Too many good docs are getting out of business. Too many OBGYNs aren't able to practice their love with women all across this country.
When Michael Moore decided to make a movie on the healthcare industry, top-level executives were on the defensive. What were they hiding?
That's not on, right?
No.
Okay.
The intent is to maximize profits.
You denied more people health care, you got a bonus.
When you don't spend money on somebody, it's a savings to the company.
I want America to have the finest health care in the world.
Four health care lobbyists for every member of Congress.
Here's what it costs to buy these men and this woman, this guy, and this guy.
And the United States slipped to 37 in health care around the world, just slightly ahead of Slovenia.
I denied a man a necessary operation and thus caused his death. This secured my reputation and it ensured my continued advancement in the healthcare field.
In the world's richest country.
I work three jobs.
You work three jobs?
Yes.
Uniquely American, isn't it? I mean, that is fantastic.
Laughter isn't the best medicine.
I get a bill from my insurance company telling me that the ambulance ride wasn't pre-approved. I don't know when I was supposed to pre-approve it. After I gained consciousness in the car, before I got in the ambulance.
It's the only medicine.
That's Sicko. And today we're joined by the director of Sicko, the Academy Award-winning filmmaker Michael Moore. His latest film is called Capitalism, a Love Story, and he's made many others. We spoke to him late yesterday and began by asking Michael for his reaction to the House vote on health care reform.
I've been pretty vocal about this. This bill was never about universal health care. You know, it did a couple of good things that could have been done at any time, I guess, like ending the pre-existing condition rule for children. It doesn't end it for adults for 4 years, so you can rack up another, you know, probably 20,000 to 40,000 deaths in the meantime from people otherwise would have received help had we truly gotten rid of the pre-existing condition thing for all citizens. But 6 months after the bill is signed by Obama, kids will be able to get coverage from a private profit-making insurance company. I don't mean to sound cynical because I understand the importance of this this vote. Certainly, had the vote gone down to defeat and the Republicans had won, I would say that. It would probably have been near impossible for President Obama to get anything through for the rest of this this Congress. So that would not have been a good idea for that kind of paralysis to set in. The larger picture here is that the private insurance companies are still the ones in charge. They're still going to call the shots. And if anything, they've just been given another big handout by the government, by guaranteeing customers. I mean, this is really kind of crazy when you think about it. Imagine Congress passing a law that required every person to buy, I mean, name any product, or watch my next movie. There's a law that says now that you have to buy a DVD of every Michael Moore film. Woohoo! It's like, hey, not a bad idea. I mean, I don't know why. That's what I'm saying. I don't know why they're so upset this week because this bill is going to line their pockets to an even greater extent.
Well, Michael, on that issue of the mandatory provision, individual mandate, you're forced to buy this product that many view as defective, that has been shown to be defective for many years. But also on the issue of abortion, you're forced to buy a product where it doesn't cover a legal medical procedure. I mean, that's a key issue here.
Right. And not only that, I mean, I understand why President Obama had to issue his declaration to get the Right to Life Democrats, led by my own personal congressman here in Michigan, Bart Stupak, why he had to get them on board. But boy, that's a sorry sight to see a president such as Obama from the Democratic Party endorsing the Hyde Amendment, which, trust me, history will view as one of a number of discriminatory practices against women in our society. This is, of course, another whole issue that you know, we're always so afraid because we always feel like we're hanging on by a thread. You know, it's a 5-4 Supreme Court decision right now. One more vote, and that could mean the end of legal abortion in this country. I think that liberals, people on the left, sometimes are maybe a little bit too afraid of going too far. But frankly, if not us, who? If we don't stand up against this, if we don't say this is wrong, if we don't speak out against it, you know, then who's going to do it? But in the long run, at least 15 million Americans are still not going to have health insurance. And as you said, those who have it are going to be forced to buy a defective product. And trust me on this one thing. The insurance companies, they're not going to go quietly into the night on this, even though they lost. They're going to find ways to trick up the system, to get around it, to raise premiums. It's not going to be as easy as it sounds. Oh, you've got a pre-existing condition, no problem. Well, not exactly no problem. You know, the so-called controls that this bill puts on them are Mickey Mouse. For instance, if they deny you health insurance, let's say Aetna won't give you health insurance because you have a pre-existing condition, and you say to them, hey, wait a minute, that's against the law. And they're going to go, whoa, yeah, sue me. Because you know what the fine is? The fine for them for denying somebody because they have a pre-existing condition? $100 a day. So if you're Aetna and you've got a patient who maybe needs $100,000 operation, what would you do? Would you pay out the $100,000 operation because the law says you have to? Or do you break the law but just get a $100 a day fine? Because, let's see, after a year, that would be $36,500 versus a $100,000 operation. Gee, I wonder which one Aetna's going to go for. And, of course, they can just hope against hope that within a year the person without the operation might be dead. So they won't have to be worrying about shelling out any more money to a doctor or to a hospital.
Academy Award-winning Michael Moore will come back to our interview in a minute. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Sharif Abdelkaddous.
And we return right now to our interview with the Academy Award-winning filmmaker Michael Moore.
Michael, you wrote a letter, How the People in My District Got Stupak to Change His Mind and Thus Save the Health Care Bill. This letter from Michael Moore, you, of course. Now, talk about Bart Stupak, because he is your congressman.
Bart Stupak is my congressman. I've known him for quite some time. I live up in northern Michigan. It's a fairly rural area, very rural, actually. His district covers 31 of Michigan's 83 counties. So that's quite a hefty portion of real estate here in the state. It's not that populated. in the last few elections has tended to vote Republican. They voted for Mr. Bush up here, and they voted for Mr. McCain. But they've elected a Democrat to Congress under the name of Bart Stupak. He's a moderate, conservative Democrat. He's done some good things. He stood up to the NRA here a few years ago when he voted for a very small amount of gun control, which up here, voting against gun control is like, you know, one of the worst sins you could commit in the woods of northern Michigan. But he did that, and the NRA ran Republicans against him to try and get him out of there, and the people voted for him. He's a former Michigan State Police officer whose teenage son took a gun, a revolver, in his house, and he was on a lot of medication that Mr. Stupak says he probably shouldn't have been on, and it was misprescribed, whatever, but sadly his son killed himself with that gun. And so Congressman Stupak voted for this gun control legislation when the NRA went after him. So he's a pretty decent guy. He's a decent person. He's not a typical politician, but he has done something that I think as Americans we don't generally like. If I could just paint us all with one brush here, and that is your private spiritual or religious beliefs, Amy, are yours. As mine are mine, or my lack of beliefs or your lack of beliefs are yours or mine too. And it's nobody's business, and nobody has a right to tell me how to behave because of how they choose to behave. And for some reason, he took it upon himself to try and derail this healthcare bill because for some reason he saw some kind of ghost, some kind of I don't know what, in the bill that was going to somehow fund abortions, which, of course, it wasn't going to do. And so he decided with some other right-to-life Democrats to stop the bill. And those of us who live up here who—and I'm not saying this just because of Democrats or Republicans or independents up here. I think generally people in northern Michigan are pretty much, you know, live and let live. And your business is your business, mine's mine. And when we have things that affect each other, then we care about that. But what you do in your bedroom or in your house, as long as it's not harmful to anyone, is not any of our business. And he decided it was his business to become chief of police for the fertilized eggs of the United States of America. And so he... He set out to stop this, and we decided that we had to stop him. So myself and dozens of others here organized over the last week or two to get everybody calling his office and emailing him, sending him letters, going to his office, and telling him in no uncertain terms that this August, in the Democratic primary, where the base votes, the liberal base votes, he will be removed from office at that point. We may or may not win in November, but we will remove him in August. And I hope that message got through to him because he changed his mind in the last moment and decided to go along with the bill.
Let me ask you about the White House strategy on this. We saw in the final weeks a lot of pressure coming down on progressives, most noticeably Dennis Kucinich, who was taken on Air Force One with Obama, and forced the next day, he switched his vote. Well, not forced, but that's what he ultimately decided to do. There didn't seem to be any consideration from the White House, from President Obama, for the public option. Throughout the months over this debate, they said they supported it, but they have not actually done anything actively to support it. And we didn't see the same kind of pressure brought to bear on people like Bart Stupak. He eventually did vote for the bill, but after a lot of concessions were made, Obama signing this executive order. Your thoughts on how President Obama led this debate?
I don't think he really cared about a public option. I don't think he really believes in true universal health care that's managed by we, the people. He was the number one recipient of health industry money in the Senate. And when he was running for president,
So I'm not surprised that he had very little interest in doing any of that. I mean, Obama right now, he's our, you know, he's the guy that isn't the last 8 years of Bush and Cheney. Boy, there's a rousing endorsement for him. I mean, I'm sorry. I feel so disillusioned. And I sit here on this camera here and I'm thinking, you know, try and sound upbeat and positive and optimistic and all this, because people are filled with such despair right now. But I'm sorry. I, too, am filled with that despair. And I think that he isn't really going to take on the powers that be. He's not really going to take on the banks and Wall Street. He cut a deal with the pharmaceutical industry so that they got completely left out. They weren't even touched by this bill. So they get to go on their merry way of bilking the public out of billions of dollars every year. So, no, I'm sorry. I just don't, you know, and I have felt through most of my life, actually, that sometimes it's worse to have the kinder, gentler version of the same bad thing than the actual bad thing, because at least when it is that bad thing, you can deal with it because you know what it is. But if you've got, as is often the case with Democrats, this mask over it that looks like a nice mask. It looks like, wow, it looks like one of us. He's, you know, saying the same things we say and feels the same way we feel. And, you know, and then every now and then does some incredibly good things. I mean, they're about ready to finally quit lying about where the poverty level is in this country. The Obama administration is going to set that bar where it really should be. You know, little things like that you hear about every week or two, they do. And you think, oh, geez, that's a hell of a lot better than Bush and Cheney. But if you step back from it, here we are now in the first week of the eighth year of the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, which Obama has decided to make it his war. And a very, very weak banking regulation bill that Chris Dodd has proposed that I believe yesterday made it through some committee or whatever there. I haven't read all the news on it today, but it's not really going to do anything to really put the reins on Wall Street or these banks in the way that it should be.
How does this tie into your film, Michael, Capitalism, A Love Story, which you've just released on DVD?
Well, I mean, to me, it all comes back to this issue of an economic system that is truly evil. And the healthcare bill that was passed ultimately will be seen as a victory for capitalism, because it protected the capitalist model of providing health care for people. In other words, we're not to help people unless there's money to be made from it. That is so patently disgusting and immoral. But that's the system. That's where we live. And that's why they're not really going to do anything to the banks. Chris Dodd the other day saying, you know, when he proposed his bill, he says, well, you know, we don't really want to punish Wall Street or these banks. Oh, really? I want to punish them. I know a lot of people that want to punish them. In fact, I thought that was the whole idea of those of you who believe in your criminal justice system, that the way we reduce crime is to make examples out of those who commit crimes. If people know that they're going to go to jail for a certain period of time, that may act as an incentive not to commit the crime. We've done the exact opposite. We've rewarded the criminals by giving them more money. So I think that, you know, I mean, I've been making these movies for 20 years now, and I said this to you a few months ago, Amy, we're out there in Utah. That's right. We were in Utah. It all comes back to the central issue that unless we restructure our economic system where we the people control it and it's set up to fairly divide the pie so that nobody goes without. We're going to continue to see more decisions made that that benefit the richest 1% that control more of our financial wealth in this country than the bottom 95% combined.
Michael Moore, remember 2004 when you went on bended knee on the Bill Maher show and begged Ralph Nader not to run for president? Do you still feel the same way? You and Ralph Nader pretty much agree on a lot of things.
I have this basic position about Ralph. I've known him for many, many years. He has done so much good for this country. People are alive as a result of the things that he worked on over the years. I also believe that he doesn't really have a handle on what the proper strategy is to get this country in our hands. And, you know, unlike Ralph, I guess maybe I'm not in this for just to say it so I can hear myself talk or to take some poser position. And I hope that doesn't sound too harsh, but I don't see, you know, I don't see him ever working with the grassroots or with the people or being in touch with the people in any way, shape, or form. And so I think that what I've proposed for the last few years is that if we really want to try and get this power in our hands, in the people's hands, in the hands of the working people of this country, then we should, on a very grassroots level, from the bottom up, be doing things to, whether it's running for local office, taking over the local Democratic Party. The game is rigged in America when it comes to third parties. There's no way that that's ever going to work. And so then how, instead of letting the game, I guess, rig us, what can we do to the game itself? And if the game is, well, we have these two political parties, which are really very much like one party, why don't we make sure that one of those parties actually is a second party and start locally and do that? And that's what I encourage people to do. That's my approach. Ralph's approach is put his name on the ballot and run for office. Where are we as a result of that? I don't see us anywhere other than in the same pitiful state we've been in for some time.
Michael, back on the issue of health care, where does the single-payer movement go right now? It's also known as Medicare for All.
I think that Dennis Kucinich and John Conyers, Alan Grayson, have to immediately be putting forth the next bill. We should not let anybody rest on any laurel here. There's nothing to be proud of with this bill being passed, other than maybe a temporary satisfaction of watching Republicans, you know, what the watching their spray on tan fall off through utter anger. But these bills have to be introduced and we have to start working on them. All of us have to start getting behind this. And maybe this will turn out to be one of these things where, you know what, people saw that it was a little bit and they wanted a little more. And so a year or two from now, we get a little more.
What do you think of President Obama's strategy of accepting hundreds of amendments by Republicans on the health care bill? In the end, not one Republican voted for it. Was it worth it?
No, of course not. I mean, but I get this part of him. I do believe that he wanted to get along. I think he saw himself in this moment in history, and he knew that there was a lot of anger toward the fact that he was elected. And he held his hand out. And, of course, all they wanted to do was crush that hand. So I hope the kumbaya is over now. Because the Democrats and President Obama need to start behaving like they won. They won by a huge margin. So at least until November, can I see a version of what that would look like? just play with me a little bit here. Just give me something. I don't think, Amy, that whatever the next bill is, that he will be welcoming their 100 amendments. I don't think we're going to see that again. I think he got pretty beaten down by this, hopefully, and learned a lesson.
Academy Award-winning filmmaker Michael Moore. By the way, if you'd like a copy of today's show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. We'll be back with Norman Finkelstein. He has a new book. It's called This Time We Went Too Far. Stay with us. Khalifa here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Sharif Abdelkadous.
Well, health care is not the only issue on President Obama's agenda today. He's also scheduled to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House. Last night, Netanyahu delivered a defiant speech before an AIPAC conference. That's the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Netanyahu vowed to continue expanding settlements in occupied East Jerusalem, despite criticism from the Obama White House.
Ladies and gentlemen, the connection between the Jewish people and the land of Israel cannot be denied. The connection between the Jewish people and Jerusalem cannot be denied. The Jewish people were building Jerusalem 3,000 years ago, and the Jewish people are building Jerusalem today. Jerusalem is not a settlement. It's our capital.
Hours before Netanyahu spoke at the AIPAC conference, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton told AIPAC attendees that the U.S. commitment to Israel's security and Israel's future is rock solid. But Clinton did criticize Israel for continuing to build settlements in occupied East Jerusalem.
New construction in East Jerusalem or the West Bank undermines that mutual trust and endangers the proximity talks that are the first step toward the full negotiations that both sides say they want and need. And it exposes daylight between Israel and the United States that others in the region hope to exploit. It undermines America's unique ability to play a role, an essential role, in the peace process. Our credibility in this process depends in part on our willingness to praise both sides when they're courageous and when we don't agree to say so, and say so unequivocally.
We're joined now here in studio by scholar and writer Norman Finkelstein. He's author of a number of books on the Israel-Palestine conflict. His latest is being released this week. It's called This Time We Went Too Far: Truth and Consequences of the Gaza Invasion. Norman Finkelstein is also the subject of a new documentary called American Radical: The Trials of Norman Finkelstein. Norman, welcome to Democracy Now! First, respond to both Secretary of State Clinton and the Israeli Prime Minister said. Secretary of State Clinton actually criticizing Israel. Did that surprise you?
It didn't really surprise me. I think one has to look at the framework of the criticism. There is an international law ruling or opinion on the question of East Jerusalem. In July 2004, the highest judicial body in the world, the International Court of Justice, it rendered what it called its advisory opinion. And it stated unequivocally that East Jerusalem is, and now I'm using its words, occupied Palestinian territory. It's not a question here of conflicting claims to Jerusalem, let alone an Israeli exclusive right to East Jerusalem. The law is clear. It's occupied Palestinian territory because it was acquired in the course of a war, in the course of the June 1967 war. And under international law, it's inadmissible to acquire territory by war. I would want to add that's the position of all human rights organizations, and it was the position of the Goldstone Report. The Goldstone Report repeatedly refers to East Jerusalem as occupied Palestinian territory. And Mr. Goldstone, by his own reckoning, is a Zionist, a lover of Israel, but he also respects the law, and the law is clear.
Well, let's talk about the Goldstone Report. You write about this extensively in the epilogue of your book. Israel and the U.S. have both rejected the war crimes allegations in the report. Talk about what the report is, who put it together, Judge Goldstone, and what the reaction from the U.S. and Israel has been.
The Goldstone Report was mandated by the United Nations Human Rights Council. Richard Goldstone, a distinguished international jurist, led the mission. And he, at the end, they published a quite substantial report that ran to some 500 pages, 550 pages. It covered a lot of ground. And it has to be said, it was quite devastating in its indictment of Israel. It concluded that Israel used disproportionate force to punish, humiliate, and terrorize a civilian population. Well, Israel was outraged by the report across the spectrum, not just the right wing, but people like Shimon Peres, who's said to be a dove. He called Richard Goldstone a small man who knows nothing about international law. Michael Oren, the Israeli ambassador to the United States, said the Goldstone report is worse than the protocols of the Elders of Zion and worse than Ahmadinejad. And the reaction was quite similar in the United States. And Goldstone replied after the criticism in the U.S. He said, okay, you say the report is deeply flawed. Show me where. And to this day, and I've read all the critiques, there have been three major ones, one by this Israeli and American professor Moshe Halbertal. There was one by Professor Dershowitz of Harvard. And the Israelis put out just last week a 500-page rebuttal. And I tried, honestly, to look at it objectively, but they were very insubstantial responses. I was quite impressed by how well Goldstone has held up to the criticism. It was a very careful, cautious, and judicious report.
And its conclusion?
Its conclusion was that both Israel and Hamas were guilty of war crimes and possible crimes against humanity, that Israel has now an obligation to investigate, an independent investigation of what happened, and if they don't conduct an independent investigation, they have to go before the International Criminal Court.
And Obama's response to this?
The Obama administration has called the report deeply flawed, but not provided any substantive evidence to support that claim.
And this latest flap between the U.S. and Israel about the expanding Jewish housing in East Jerusalem, mm-hmm. It's been a lot about diplomatic ties, but they have not talked at all about holding any U.S. military aid or economic mm-hmm. aid to Israel. Talk about the level of aid to Israel. In fact, Hillary Clinton extolled the fact that it's increased in 2010, military aid to Israel.
Well, I'm sure all of your listeners and your viewers are familiar with the magnitude of U.S. aid to Israel. I think the important development is what Amnesty International said after the invasion of Gaza. It put out a very substantial report called Fueling Conflict, and it said that transferring weapons to a consistent violator of human rights is illegal under international law. Israel is a consistent violator of human rights, and therefore there has to be a comprehensive arms embargo on Israel. And the report went into each country in the world, how it supplies and transfers weapons to Israel. But it has to be said, the focus was on the United States. And Amnesty International said three main things. Number one, that the U.S. is by far the biggest supplier of weapons to Israel. Number two, supplying those weapons to Israel is not only illegal under international law, it's illegal under domestic U.S. law. And number three, it said, and I think it's important for your viewers to hear it, Amnesty International said what happened in Gaza could, and they described what happened in Gaza as 22 days of death and destruction. What happened in Gaza could not have happened were it not for U.S. taxpayer money. If you're appalled by what happened in Gaza, you're appalled by the death, the destruction, the systematic attack on mosques, the systematic attack on ambulances, the systematic attack on hospitals, on schools.
And these are detailed in the Goldstone report?
Yes. The 6,000 homes, which were all either completely or nearly completely destroyed, Amnesty International says all of that was paid for with U.S. taxpayer money. And now along comes Hillary Clinton, and she's extolling U.S. military aid to Israel. The part that she left out is, number one, it's all illegal under international and domestic U.S. law. And number two, it was that U.S. aid that made possible. You have to bear in mind, I know your program chronicled the use of the white phosphorus. Every white phosphorus shell they found, you can see it in the Human Rights Watch report on the white phosphorus, every one was made in the United States. We are responsible for that war. And that's just, it's not just a cliche, it's a factual matter. We made that massacre happen.
This Time We Went Too Far is the name of your new book out this week. A quote.
Yeah, the quote comes from the Israeli columnist Gideon Levy, and I think it captured the essence of the book, namely that Israel crossed a threshold with what it did in Gaza, because it was actually, in the past, you can say, Israeli conflicts with its neighbors had both a military component and a component that targeted civilians. Usually, the component that targeted civilians was on par or even larger than the component of military engagement. But Gaza was not about it's not a war, because there was no military engagement. As one of Israel's strategic analysts said, there was no war in Gaza. There were no battles in Gaza. And Israel conducted or executed a massacre against a defenseless civilian population. And it became indefensible. And that's why, to this day, quite a lot of time has already elapsed, and you would think people had forgotten about the Gaza massacre. It's already a year and a half. People's memories are short. But they can't, Israel has been unable to escape the shadow, the ghost of Gaza, in part because they went too far, and in part because of the Goldstone report. Because typically Israel uses the slurs of anti-Semite, Holocaust denier, self-hating Jew in order to discredit the critics of its policies. But with Richard Goldstone, given his background, a Zionist, a lover of Israel, sits in the board of governors of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. His mother was an activist in the Zionist movement. His daughter did Aliyah to Israel. Those slurs just didn't stick with Goldstone. And actually, Netanyahu, in one of his speeches, he said one of our three biggest challenges, he listed first the threat posed by Iran, and the second biggest challenge he listed was the Goldstone report.
Well, Norman, speaking of criticism of people who criticize Israeli foreign policy, there's a new documentary about you called American Radical, The Trials of Norman Finkelstein. I want to turn to a clip of it. This bit, it talks about how the Israeli-Palestinian conflict first piqued your interest.
My first involvement publicly and politically with the Israel-Palestine conflict was the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in June 1982. The estimates are, you know, somewhere around 20,000 Palestinian and Lebanese, overwhelmingly civilians, were killed. Immediately as the war began, I start to demonstrate outside the Israeli consulate, right off 42nd Street. I was out there every day, every night, and I had a big poster which read, "This son of survivors of the Warsaw Ghetto, Auschwitz and Majdanek will not be silent. Israeli Nazis stop the Holocaust in Lebanon." I did manage to get all of that on one poster. And so I started to read voraciously on the Israel-Palestine conflict.
That's an excerpt of the new documentary, American Radical, The Trials of Norman Finkelstein. Norman, your thoughts about this movie, and also talk about your own family's history. It's very interesting. It goes through, talks about your parents, both Holocaust survivors. And also, if you can talk about Benjamin Netanyahu referencing the Holocaust yesterday in his speech to AIPAC.
Well, I've not actually seen the movie, but those who are close friends of mine and did see it, most of them, not all, but most of them thought it was an accurate depiction of me, for better or for worse. It's like the Chinese proverb, "May you live in interesting times." I'm not sure if that's a compliment or not, but they say it's accurate. My parents obviously had a huge impact on me, especially morally. My mother was very smart, but she did not like to discuss war in intellectual terms because she felt to intellectualize it was somehow to not capture the horror of what war was. So during, let's say, the Vietnam War, when we used to watch Firing Line, and there would be debates between William Buckley and John Kent Galbraith, or William Buckley and, well, the fellow's name just slips my mind. But, and then they would, at the end of the debate, they would get up and shake hands and pat each other on the back. And it was like, my mother was so appalling. You're debating life and death and dropping napalm on kids. And then at the end, you just get up and shake hands. Like, it's not serious. So at that point in my life, I found it very hard to talk rationally about war. And I felt it was a betrayal of my parents to have intellectual debates about it. And I think until I started to read Professor Chomsky's writings, and I found that you can have a reasoned, you can make a reasoned argument and still preserve the moral force behind your feelings, until I read him, I was not very articulate in talking about it. Now I feel pretty able to.
Norman, we just have less than a minute to go. You end this time we went too far by mentioning Gandhi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I spent the last year reading through about 25,000 pages of Gandhi, which is about half his collected works. I found him a deeply inspiring figure, both personally and politically. And I think his approach can work in the Israel-Palestine conflict. It would take me some time to go through it because Gandhi's not nearly as obvious as people think. They just think Gandhi, nonviolence. No, there was a quite subtle, nuanced theory there. But I think what he has to say is relevant to the Israel-Palestine conflict. And I think the strategy that's now being used by Palestinians around the wall and in East Jerusalem, the kinds of tactics that Gandhi pioneered, I think those have the best chances for success.
Norman Finkelstein, his book out this week, This Time We Went Too Far, Truth and Consequences of the Gaza Invasion. The film is also out. It's called American Radical, The Trials of Norman Finkelstein. That does it for our show. If you'd like a copy, go to our website. Happy birthday to Miriam Bernard. I'm Amy Goodman with Sharif Abdul-Quddus. Thanks for joining us.